Group meeting, Saturday, 14th January 1989. First of all, my heartfelt thanks for all the Christmas and New Year gifts and greetings that you sent me. And secondly, for all that I have learned from all of you through our meetings. This is our last group weekend for the 27th year since we started. You have all been a source of insight, inspiration, and correction for me throughout these 27 years. Only Frank Dennis, who came to the very first Saturday meeting, is not here. Without you, your patience, your fidelity, and your love and sincerity and continued support, my books could not have been written. If you find truth and wisdom, love and beauty in them, rest assured, you have contributed no small measure to these spiritual riches. To all of you, I am deeply grateful. You may wonder why I said your insight, inspiration, and correction. Meetings like this, in my case, always open my eyes to deeper things. Some word here, some phrase there, and there is an insight as a result of that. You yourselves perhaps are unaware of it, but I am only too well aware. And I can assure you that a good deal which has come out in the books, 5 books in all now, there will be as soon as this last one is printed, are due to your presence and the effect you have had upon me. So much for insight and inspiration. You may wonder about correction. Often, the questions you ask or the things you say, as and when I remember them, make me think afterwards of what I myself have said and find that I have been, to use classical English, been talking through my hat. So, I am truly grateful to all of you for these. Now, during these 27 years, we have had 426 Saturday meetings, including this one, 376 Friday meetings, which were concluded on the 26th of July last year. See, the Friday meetings started later than the Saturday meetings. They started the same year, but in July, wasn't it? There is one of the Friday meeting members. And then a year later, we started the Sunday meetings, of which we have had so far 387. It will be 88 tomorrow. Altogether, 1,185 meetings here in this house. And it is only this weekend that Sylvia is no longer here. In addition, we have had 15 group summer schools at which I must have given at least 150 lectures, because I used to speak twice each day, you remember, morning and afternoon, or evening as the case might be. And we had 1 day for silence and 5 days on which we talked and discussed and so forth. So I make it out totally as 1,330 meetings in connection with this work. And what is this work? This work is concerned with the living of the religious life. It's not concerned purely or simply with the doctrines and dogmas. It is not a matter of purely intellectual study and discussion. Study has to be there, of course, and the intellect, of course, has to work. But it is not purely that. It is not purely a matter of emotion, which needs rituals, ceremonies, prayers, and whatnot, you see. But it is a case of understanding how we can live our daily secular life, domestic life, business life, social life, and so forth, political life, economic life, in virtuously. And this is the important thing, the really important thing. In other words, for me, the religious life is no other than the secular life lived virtuously. Not that I have been myself an example to myself anyway, especially in my young years. And now it is a little bit different, just a little bit different. Now, I'd like to mention how all this work started. The English bhikkhu, the Venerable Panyavadho, he was a brilliant man, intellectually. I think he was a Cambridge man, too. He heard me speak at the Buddhist Society several times. And he saw that I knew something at least about the real background to the Buddha's teachings. Namely, of course, the Vedic and Upanishadic teachings. I said and Upanishadic, but the Upanishads are part of Vedic literature as such. And he realized that one of the points which I used to emphasize at these lectures for the Buddhist Society, that it is essential to know and understand the Upanishadic teachings and the mode of life laid down in those teachings in order to appreciate more fully the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha possibly was, probably in fact, was the greatest psychologist the world has seen. He saw and understood human nature as no one in his time understood it. And therefore, He gave a teaching in which the greatest possible emphasis was laid upon the ethical side of life. In other words, as I put it, to live virtuously. Because that was the only way in which the individual person could come to fruition and find himself in right and perfect relationship with his whole environment, with all humanity. That was the Buddha's greatness, especially. Now, the Venerable Paniyavado, seeing this, before he went to Thailand, when I used to go and see him to discuss certain points about the Buddha's teachings, he asked me one day to start a group within the confines of the Buddhist society, of course, at that time, and teach the people the background to Buddhism, namely, of course, the Upanishadic teachings. And I said to him, "But, Venerable Sir, I know what an incapable and ignorant person I am. How can I teach members of the Buddhist society?" And he just smiled. And when I went the next time, which was about 2 weeks or so before he was due to go to Thailand, he once again asked me to form this group. And once again I gave him the same reply. Who am I to teach others? And he again smiled. Then about 4 days before he flew to Thailand, I saw him for the last time, and again he said, "For the third time, you really must form a group like this and do what you can, what you think you can, despite your belief in your ignorance and incapacity." Now, when a man like him asked me 3 times, it would have been too rude, too inconsiderate, not to comply with his request. So, of course, I had a notice put up in the Buddhist Society, and we started the group. On the 10th of February, 1962, there were 7 of us at that first meeting. And I made it clear to them that I was not here to teach them, but to serve them. They were to regard me as their servant, and I would try to do the best I could to help them with their spiritual life. And so, between 1962 and 1969, we had so many meetings, every fortnight in those days. And then later on, when Beryl Jenks came to England, and she joined the group, and she met others who members of the School of Economic Science and people like that, and they began to come in, and the groups grew. That's how the groups have grown. There was a time when we had Friday, Saturday and Sunday, 3 meetings in succession, and roughly 90 or more people would be present on those three days. Not on each day, but the 3 days together. So that's the sort of story of the growth of the baby, which was the group. Now, my special interest, not merely in recent years, but right from my childhood, literally from the time I was 5 and 6, was to pester my mother with the question, "What is immortality?" because they are living in the East, in Colombo actually. One constantly saw what death was, the death of animals, the death of human beings. One was well acquainted with funerals and all that kind of thing, right from our early years. And death was not a subject which was taboo in conversation. And of course, immortality was defined as living forever and ever. And how could you live forever and ever, I asked my mother, when you died and you were buried or you were cremated? That was the absolute end, obviously. And so it is, of the particular organism. And of course, poor dear mother couldn't give this conceitedly intellectual child an explanation which would satisfy him. So that question has always pursued me throughout the years, and of course interested me in religions, all the religions of the world as such. All the religions, because there in Colombo, people of who were members of all the religions lived, and in my school there were boys who belonged to all the different religions, and we often discussed and argued fiercely. We never came to blows, fortunately, like history has shown in the case of the Crusades and various other wars like that. You see, we never came to that position, but we discussed and discussed for a very long time. Now, in trying to understand the meaning of immortality, I gradually began to realize the necessity not only for study, but also for meditation. And I have actually practiced the systems of Zarathustrianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity. I've forgotten the name of rather a famous writer who, it was John Watkins of Watkins's shop who advised me to study that book if I wanted to know about Christian meditation and so forth, which I did, you see, and practiced for a while. But I began to see that all of these missed out something. They talked in terms of the unio mystica, to use the Christian phrase, or moksha, as the Hindus would say, or the cessation, as we have in Buddhist terminology. But they missed out the nature of that unification, the nature of that realization of transcendence. Of course, I have used the word transcendence particularly because the word God or Brahman or Allah or Ahuramazda, all these words have become considerably loaded, and therefore they have spoilt the meaning of these words. They have become intellectualized largely. And seeing, I saw the importance of realizing somehow and trying to bring about the unification of religions, which of course made me ask myself, how does the teachings of the founder of a religion or of any true spiritual teacher come into being? And it struck me that he speaks from a depth of consciousness, from a level of understanding and transcendent perception, which is quite different from the understanding and perception of ordinary human beings. And what was that particular level and how was it attained or achieved? Of course, those were the days when still it was a case of achievement or attaining. And I gradually came to realize that there is no such thing as achieving and attaining in this matter. Because, partly through a certain experiences which I myself had, I saw that achieving and attaining still keeps you separate from the totality. You achieve, you attain. Look at the way we talk about ourselves. I think, I feel, I speak, I act or work or do. It is always related to the self, and there is a self. The self is separated from the totality always. So I realized that this unification of the religious disciplines must be something where the self did not disappear, the self remained there, but through that self something transcendent could supervene, could come to play. Now, how could it come to play? And here I saw that all the religions emphasized one thing particularly, namely the ethical life, to live by not only the social values, the business values, and the ordinary moralities of the secular life, but through the great spiritual values such as love, wisdom, truth, purity, goodness, beauty, and so on. And I also saw that these things are not achieved or attained by anybody. But there is a way by which one could so purify oneself, the psychophysical organism, that this transcendent consciousness is able to function in terms of what we call the great spiritual values through the particular person. And that is why, particularly since 1978 and 79, I introduced the ideas of the context in which transcendence functions. And it is the context of the infinite and the eternal. These words we have applied, all the religions have applied, to God or the Supreme Being or to Brahman or what you call it. They always talk of that, of the ultimate, as being infinite, as being eternal, therefore immortal, whereas I, the ordinary individual, function in terms of the finite, the temporal, and therefore the mortal, and so forth. I function in terms of separateness from the totality. God is a granted omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. Well, I think now, I'm sure now, that the presentations of God throughout the religions, or transcendence throughout the religions, are expressions of man's own tinkling aspiration towards his own ultimate fulfillment. And I began to see clearly that what changes throughout the entire evolutionary process is, and what develops, is consciousness. We find consciousness first faintly in the plant world, then in the animal world, and then through the evolutionary process, especially amongst the hominoidea, of whom the hominids are a branch. The hominids are we ourselves. In us, consciousness has reached the highest possible development on this planet. What may happen elsewhere, I don't know. But on this planet, it is man who can develop that state of pure being through, because of which this transcendent consciousness, which I call holistic consciousness, holistic meaning healthy, whole, perfect, can function, which is the consciousness we ascribe to all our presentations of the Supreme Being. Now, in connection with this, you may remember that through our group meetings, we have tried to understand the teachings of the Veda, the Upanishads, the Kabbalah, the Buddha, Sri Krishna, and in some meetings which were held separately, Krishnamurti's teachings and so forth. I think Krishnamurti was one of the supreme teachers of the 20th century. He was a pure man, a truly pure man. Now, I have tried to serve the groups to the best of my little abilities as far as I could. But I have come to the end. This will be our last group weekend of the kind that we have had throughout these 27 years. I am really worn out, and I think I've done what was possible for me to do. But I'm not deserting you. I'd like to suggest that we carry on, those who wish to, that is, that we carry on in a slightly different way. Namely, let four or five members who know each other well, especially those who know each other well, who are in sympathy and in harmony with each other, let them form several groups like that. Altogether we have about 35, 40 people who are the core of these groups, you see, so that six or seven groups may emerge out of them, and let them arrange by themselves when they would like to come, and the date and the time, and of course if it is also convenient for me, we shall meet here. But the group, the members of the groups must themselves carry on the work of the groups. Let them participate, let them discuss. No argumentativeness, but a pure discussion. That's to say, you express your own perception, your own understanding, and learn from the perceptions and understanding of all the others. And I will be learning from you too. You see, particularly in this last book, I have emphasized one thing very, very strongly. That every single human being in the world is a unique individual. You see, if you study the procreative process, you will see that it was impossible for any human being not to be unique, any human organism not to be unique. Each one of us in the world is different from everybody else in certain respects. Particularly where the psyche and the mind are concerned. Physically, we are very similar. Everybody, every human being is composed of bones, blood, flesh, skin, and organs which function in the same way as anybody else's organs, you see. That is where we are just identical with each other. But in all other ways, we are different. I shouldn't say all, in many other ways we are different. And we are particularly different in our aspiration and our ability to work towards the fruition of our human nature. I have stated categorically, and I abide by that statement, that the destiny of the human being, of all human beings, not that all will ever achieve it, but a good many can, the destiny of human beings is so to purify the organism physically and psychically that this holistic consciousness, which is a universal consciousness, which is the divine consciousness, can supervene and function through that person. That way, we affect not only our own lives, but our entire environment and the whole of humanity in the best possible way. Mankind is very ignorant still of the purpose of existence, or purposes, perhaps, of existence. I can put them in three or four different ways. But the important way is so to live that holistic consciousness can function freely through us. The Buddhists have said that pure mind ultimately functions through the perfected Holy One. Now, pure mind necessitates some sort of conception of mind. Just as, in fact, the word consciousness also needs some conception of what consciousness means. But mind is rather too vague. Consciousness can be seen clearly as being the faculty of knowingness. The Latin scire, to know, scio, I know, you see, scire, to know. That is the root of the shas part, and con means together with. It brings about the sense of totality, so that capacity for this holistic consciousness, which can function as and when you yourself need it or wish it, through the whole psychophysical organism in the context of infinity and immortality. And that means that our ordinary consciousness, which functions in terms of the finite and temporal, is always going to function purely. You yourselves, therefore, will never do any harm to anybody in the world. You will truly be peacemakers. You know how Jesus said, I think that was the last beatitude, wasn't it? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. That's what he said. Now look, children, and throughout the conventional teachings of the religions, we find mankind presented as the child of God. Now you know that an elephant, for instance, can only give birth to a baby elephant. A mosquito will only produce a mosquito. An oak tree will only produce a seed which will be another oak tree, and so forth. And human beings can only produce children who are human beings. They can't be lions and tigers and so forth, you see. Although some behave as if they were not quite human. So now, the child of God, means the child of that which is transcendentally peaceful, loving, truthful, wise, good, and beautiful. Now, I emphasize the idea of beauty, not only because Plato, in his philosophy, talked of the three great ideas, truth, goodness, and beauty, but because in the Trismegistic teachings we find this wonderful statement, All Father God then produced man with whom he fell in love because he was so beautiful and bestowed upon him all his own powers and faculties. So you see, man's destiny is to be a god in the real sense of the term. Pythagoras, in the golden sayings of Pythagoras, practically the last saying, I've quoted it in The Heart of Religion, in chapter 3, or is it 2, I can't remember. He says, and when thou hast gone past all mortality, then thou shalt be, when thou hast transcended the body as such, the body meaning the physical body and of course the psyche too, when thou hast transcended, thou shalt be a god immortal and thou shalt never know death. The body as a material instrument of course necessarily is subject to death, and it will die. It must die. It would be a pity if it didn't die, because with the passage of time, it grows old, it decays, it loses faculties, and becomes a burden and a nuisance to other human beings. I am very, very conscious of that myself. That is why I don't look forward to living many years, or maybe only a short time, I would prefer. So, the children of God. But there is another thing too. Every one of you can be one of the children of the new dawn. A phrase I have used frequently, especially in the Buddhist summer schools. To be children of the new dawn. Who else but people like yourselves who are concerned with the living of the religious life, which is the secular life lived virtuously? Who else but yourselves can sing the song of infinity and of eternity? It is only you who can do that. You are the heralds of the infinite and the eternal. And it depends upon how you live. Now, I said that I'm not deserting you, and I've suggested that these groups be formed and we meet. But remember, if there are five, six different groups, they would have to meet at some considerable interval of time. There is another thing. A trust has been formed, called after my name, the Firoz Mehta Trust. And the trustees are Rosemary Monk, George Piggott, and his son Michael Piggott, who used to come here to the Friday meetings. They can't come on Saturdays and Sundays, unfortunately. And so you don't see them ever here. And then there is Stephen Marshall, and there is my younger son Robert. Those are the five trustees. We are preparing a leaflet in connection with the work which can be done, and Rosemary has turned up trumps offering her house as a home for all the records that I have. I think there are about 600 to 700 recordings, and all my books on religion and philosophy, about 650 or so of them, and various other books, literature and so forth, including translations of the Greek writers and authors, and so on. So you will have the opportunity to meet there after my death and carry on the work if you feel that you would like the work to go on. Work in harmony, respecting everybody's opinion and idea. But don't forget that you are unique. And in the discovery of your own uniqueness is very, very important. And let those meetings serve the purpose of each person at the meetings in Rosemary's House, serve the purpose of discovering your uniqueness and of helping your environment and all whom you come across. My love and gratitude will always be with you. Thank you.